I'd like to welcome Greg Holmes and Catherine Roth to Michigan Writers on the Air. Welcome.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thanks, Aaron.
Greg is a clinical psychologist, and Catherine is an MD and a board-certified family physician. And today we're going to be talking about their memoir, which they co-authored, A Good Fight, A Story of Cancer, Love, and Triumph. So this story goes back to 2004, about 10 years ago.
Yes.
And you'd been bothered by...
I've been bothered by congestion in my left nasal passage. And for several months, we tried a number of different things.
Mm-hmm. And then we get to the actual story. And we're going to start by actually having you read from the book, the opening section, or one of the opening sections. And it represents what's in the book, because the book is a conversation between the two of you based on this experience.
Okay.
Okay, so if we can start there, Greg?
Sure. On April 1st, I went to a coffee shop and looked for a newspaper to read, and I found a copy of the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal held little of interest to me. I found the seemingly endless stock and bond tables, graphs, and stories about mergers and acquisitions to be quite boring. However, that day in the Wall Street Journal was an article that was of no laughing matter. It was just the opposite, a compelling story about the struggles of Andy Martin, a third-year medical student at Tulane. The article described how he was diagnosed with sinonasal undifferentiated cancer, or SNUC, a disease that was so rare that only 100 cases were documented in the medical literature. The cancer was described as one that killed. It was an extremely aggressive and destructive illness with virtually no chance of survival. With so few cases, there was little desire by the pharmaceutical companies to conduct research on the disease. The article described how Mr. Martin was growing cancer cells extracted from his nose in a desperate attempt to find a chemotherapy drug that would slow the progress of the tumor and prolong his life. The account of his struggle disturbed me, and I was immediately overcome with a feeling of shame. I was completely embarrassed with how irritated and self-absorbed I'd become with the problems with my own nose. I'd been obsessing about the fact that an antibiotic prescribed in New Zealand hadn't worked after all, and when we returned home, an ear, nose, and throat specialist discovered a polyp in my nostril. He believed it was the culprit behind my congestion. He biopsied the polyp and informed me that I would have to undergo outpatient surgery to remove it. I dreaded the thought of surgery, as it meant intravenous sedation, and I had a big time phobia about needles. However, I agreed to proceed. At least we'd get the darn thing out of my nose and be done with it once and for all. All this time, I had been kvetching about my pesky nose and whining about someone putting a needle in my arm. And there was brave Andy Martin, left on his own, soon to be in the grave. A feeling of comparative gratitude finally settled over me as I finished my coffee, grabbed my backpack briefcase, and walked across Front Street to my office. An odd thought popped up on the desktop of my consciousness. What if the story I read in the Wall Street Journal was meant to be there for a reason and for me to read it? The only thing I was sure of that had been a humiliating lesson, one that I promised I would never forget. I was the fool that April morning.
Since the beginning of the year, I'd watched Greg struggle with sinus congestion that refused to improve. We tried everything, neti pots, eucalyptus steam, echinacea tea, decongestants, antihistamines, steroid sprays, and antibiotics. Even the tincture of thyme failed him. I encouraged him to return to his local doctor. I was equally worried, if not more so, about Greg's increasing frustration and preoccupation with the congestion. The man I knew and adored was generous, fun-loving, and optimistic to a fault. We had been together 15 years and often debated the question of whether the glass was half empty or half full. There was no debate, really. When I wasn't worried about Greg's congestion, I allowed myself to admit I was bored by it all. Wasn't there something more important to think and obsess about than a stuffy nose? I mean, really? The next day, though, feeling a little ashamed by my annoyance, the worry reappeared. On March 30th, Greg saw an ENT. Greg was the last patient of the day, and we perched on the edge of our chairs in the empty waiting room. An ancient issue of People's Magazine lay between us, and we reached over to hold each other's hand. Greg's was damp and cold. He had been stoic for months, but now he was openly distraught. The nurse escorted us back to the exam room where we met Dr. Norgaard and poured out our story while he listened and took notes. Then he examined Greg's nose with his endoscope and quickly pronounced that he could see a fleshy polyp on the left side. He asked me if I wanted to have a look. I hesitated, not as a fellow doctor, but as Greg's wife. But ultimately, I peered through the scope. To my relief, I saw only a small pink plumpness. There was no monster, no boogeyman. I reached for Greg's trembling hand and sent him my best reassuring smile. Dr. Norgaard felt confident it was most likely a benign polyp and it could be surgically removed. Then he threw us off when he asked to take a biopsy, just to be sure. Panic flashed in Greg's eyes. He had a disabling fear of needles and blood that I could never calm with reason or sympathy, yet he mustered up his best adult self that day and agreed to proceed. The biopsy was quick, and within minutes it was over. Shaken but relieved by our encounter, we collected our things. The next day, April 1st, I awoke early and went to my desk. I frequently wrote in the morning stillness, pondering my dreams and meditations before the busyness of the day stripped them away. What work did we need to do that was so intimately linked? I realized that to help him, I needed to listen more deeply. Several hours later, I was driving west across town. Suddenly, my beeper went off, putting an abrupt end to the moment. I pulled over and dialed the number on my cell. I immediately recognized Dr. Norgaard's voice. I could hear agitation in his voice, and I steadied myself with a deep breath. My heart was beating rapidly. Catherine? We got the biopsy report back, and I wanted to get back to you as soon as possible. He paused. I waited. It looks like Greg's polyp is actually cancer. I paused for a moment before saying anything. Had I misunderstood him? My mouth went dry, and the world around me began to recede. I asked him to start over. Suspended in the vacuum of the phone call, I heard his voice repeat that the biopsy indeed showed cancer. I spoke again, this time desperately asking if this was an April Fool's joke. He paused and gravely said, "I wish it were." A walking casualty, I stumbled across the street. I remembered my disturbing dream and then forced it away. All of a sudden, Greg's life became a fragile, precious treasure. Like a mirage, it flickered before me. I needed to call Greg.
When I answered the phone, Catherine sounded as if she was in a state of hysteria. The extreme sense of urgency in her voice sent a chill through my body. I knew immediately that some horrible disaster was unfolding. My nervous system went on red alert. My body tensed as I braced myself for the bad news that was sure to follow. "Are you sitting down?" she asked. "Oh my God," I thought, my mind leaping immediately to the worst possible scenario. "No! Something must have happened to Emerson, our daughter. No! Please, God, no." "Greg," she continued, "I'm at the hospital. Dr. Norgaard paged me. He wanted me to let you know that he got the results of your biopsy from the pathologist. He said the growth in your nose is not a polyp after all. It's a tumor. It's cancer." "What? How could I have cancer?" Catherine and I had been the poster children of good health for many years. Neither of us smoked. We both drank a half glass of red wine each evening. Our diet was replete with organic fruits and vegetables. We exercised routinely. We meditated, did yoga stretches, and went off as seekers on spiritual retreats. We helped many others change their unhealthy habits and states of mind. We were so good. Ironically, Catherine and I had just finished leading a support group at the local hospital for cancer patients, advising them how to change their lifestyle in order to avoid a reoccurrence of their disease. How was it possible that now I was one of them? There was no way. Catherine's voice on the phone jolted me back to the present. "I can't believe it," she exclaimed, mirroring my own thoughts. "How do they know?" I asked. "I asked Dr. Norgaard," she replied, "and he read the pathology report to me. It said the results from the biopsy are conclusive. It's cancer. Did he say he was sure? I asked. I was hoping for a second opinion from the same doctor. Perhaps there'd been a horrible mistake, some mix-up in the pathology lab of my biopsy with someone else's. He said it was definitely cancer, she repeated. She paused for a moment and then continued with the words that would become my death sentence. The pathologist said it was some kind of type of rare cancer. Sinonasal cancer. It couldn't be. Sinonasal undifferentiated cancer, snuck. The same cancer I'd read about that morning in the coffee shop. Andy Martin's disease. The article was so disturbing that it remained firmly stuck on the Velcro of my consciousness. The words from the article flew through my mind, repeating over and over again as if they were blazing across the news ticker high above Times Square. Rare. Worse cancer. Aggressive. No treatment. No hope. No survivors. Death. Rare. Worse cancer. Aggressive. No treatment. No hope. Without the slightest hint of warning, our idyllic It's a Wonderful Life morphed into a nightmare and was racing to a tragic conclusion. The truth was that I had Andy Martin's disease, sinonasal cancer. I became case 101 that day, and I was going to die.
Greg Holmes, Catherine Roth, reading from The Good Fight, a story of cancer, love, and triumph. The book is about 350 pages long. This narrative continues on in the same way, point, counterpoint, each one of your voices. What was the process in writing this?
Well, actually, the process of writing started while we were actually going through the event. I was journaling, and so that helped me therapeutically. It wasn't with any intention that we would ever write a book, but I was kind of writing, you know, so much of the book holds very, you know, accurate reflections of what I was going through at the time.
And journaling has been a part of your life for a long time.
Yes.
So this was just sort of an extension of what you did.
Right. My husband jokes with me that I have a closet full of journals. But anyways, I was journaling, and then later we were encouraged by Ann Stanton, a reporter at Northern Express, to write our story. And then at that point, Greg and I are both writing individually. We would write a whole section, and then she had the idea of splicing it together. So she took the story from each of us and crafted it together by alternating voice. And so it really, really worked for us once our voices became woven together like that.
Mm-hmm. And it really works for the reader. It's mm-hmm. very dramatic. There's a constant tension in the text. So, Catherine, what was the next step in the treatment?
We went for our consultation and went to the ear, nose, and throat, and they went through a lot of examinations of Greg repeatedly, looked at his scans, and then they informed us that, you know, he wasn't really going to see the surgeon today because he wasn't a candidate. So at that point, they said, your options are to begin chemotherapy and radiation.
And this is in Ann Arbor.
Right.
Yes, at the University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is a long, hard period for both of you. Would you talk about it?
It was difficult. It was, I think, like a lot of people who hear the word cancer, we were stunned and shocked, desperate. And, you know, especially to hear that here was a rare cancer that there was no treatment for, no hope. When we went to Ann Arbor and consulted with the doctors, they readily admitted they didn't know what to do. They were going to throw some chemo and radiation at me. But they had no idea. So it was shocking, and our whole life was altered. Everything has changed. The whole plan, right. Life plan had changed.
So. And the radiation therapy, to be put in a room, to have your head mounted against a table so you couldn't move, to be totally isolated behind steel and lead.
Yes.
It had to be sort of terrifying.
Exactly. I was put in a dark room. It was, I describe in the book, it was a cavernous room, and you're measured and bolted to a sort of a steel table that slides, you know, that can slide in to the room there, the table, and the techs are, radiation techs are up in a control booth, and they're protected by these thick lead walls, and it's a dramatic experience. You're measured for a mask, and they took a green square of mesh, dipped it in water, and then put it on my face, and it forms a mask. And they take that mask and they bolt your mask. Once they put your face in it again, they bolt that mask to a table, the steel table. So, and I say in the book, I describe in the book looking, you know, my head is bolted to the table, but I'm looking up at the walls and I see shelves with many green masks up there. It's like my ancestors are looking down.
One of the interesting things for me was that I knew very little of the details of what Greg went through until we wrote the book.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a process of discovery, of a very intimate, we were both going through this, but there was pieces that neither of us knew how the other felt, or we're not maybe even willing to tell each other how we felt at the time.
Now, he started experiencing a lot of the side effects of chemotherapy and radiation, which are sort of poisons, both of them.
Right.
And you started working on alternative ways of helping him through this part of the therapy.
Right.
Things that were not offered by the University of Michigan Medical Center. They were sort of outside of standard practice.
Right. You know, Greg mentioned in the reading that we had actually been leading a cancer group at Munson. And so I was interested in nutrition and complementary medicine since for many, many years. And so in this cancer group, I was beginning to become familiar with a body of literature that was complementary to traditional care to begin. And so actually, you know, after a few days of shock, even after the diagnosis, I sort of sat up and bolt right and said, we got to get started. So we actually started doing a lot of complementary work even before we got to Ann Arbor. And that was looking at his overall nutrition and sort of getting to boister up his immune system to get through this. So I began implementing things that I had just read about academically and mm-hmm. said, okay, we're going to really jump into this and do what I know, what just kind of by my, you know, bumbling along, figuring it out, and trying to locate substances that I had never even prescribed before. So Greg was like one of my first cancer patients that I really treated complementary therapy with.
You might say guinea pig, Aaron. you might describe it that way. But I think one of the keys to what Catherine did is she's been interested in this for many, many years. But with my treatment, we jumped right on it. We didn't wait. Catherine did it preemptively, you know. So when they biopsied my tumor, it wouldn't spread. She gave me some medication that ensured that it wouldn't spread, because she'll explain maybe that during a biopsy, the cancer can spread.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
The physicians who treated you with the state of the art of their approach to medicine, but they were not particularly hopeful.
Well, again, because the cancer that Greg had was large, so he was not surgically candidate, so that was giving them some cause to pause, like, okay, it's pretty far advanced. And mm-hmm. then also, it's a cancer we haven't had much experience with. We're not really quite sure how it's going to respond to our treatment. And I think that's one of the qualifying things about physicians, they don't want to mislead you. And so it's almost a fault, because, you know, people do need to have hope, but they're reluctant to do that if they're not really sure they can do that. They don't want to just pretend that they have hope when they really don't. So they were very kind of withholding of that.
But the psychological aspect, the need for hope and support,
yes,
you helped each other, and your friends helped you enormously.
Right.
Yes, it was a dramatic difference. The oncologist really breasted their cards, so to speak. They were not about to. I mentioned this in the book, where I was desperate to hear them say, "Yes, there's a chance. Yes, there's hope. Yes, you might be able to do this." They never did that, and on the other hand, friends would come up to us and say, "I know you're going to beat this. I know you're going to, you're going to do this. And I was so, as I mentioned, so desperate to hear that, like a person has crawled through the desert and then you get a thimble full of water. And I would just gurgle it down, that hope, you know. Mm-hmm. It was just, oh, it's so, so hungry for it.
Individual chapters in the book contain references to the various treatments that you gave Greg.
Right. I was very excited as I was reading, discovering that there's this growing body of knowledge that is out there about complementary medicine and nutrition and herbs that can actually enhance the effectiveness of cancer therapies and decrease the toxicity. So it was spurring me on to keep reading, and I felt great hope knowing we had another arsenal in our favor, and tried to communicate that to Greg. But I was really doing most of this behind the scenes and trying not to burden him with too much of the details. So as the reader's reading it, they can see both the story, which is holds its own, but there's also this other thread running through it that imparts all the knowledge that I learned with, you know, separate graphs and charts and stuff with very specific references. So if people want to look into it themselves, there is available to them.
Mm-hmm. You also bring to this something that's very interesting. There are other healing traditions mm-hmm. besides Western medicine. And you bring to the reader the Oriental traditions, acupuncture, other therapeutic approaches.
Right. So in the book, it's divided into three parts. The first part describes our chemotherapy radiation experience. And then the second part goes into more of our eclectic searchings. And we do experiment and experience Eastern dimension of healing with acupuncture and energy work.
Mm-hmm. I think that it's important to say, too, about that, that at the end of the radiation and chemotherapy treatment in Ann Arbor, I was nearly dead. I was just holding on to your life. Mm-hmm. And they were not telling us that the cancer was gone. So we were, again, so desperate that we needed to turn to other traditions, to other orientations for our help. And that's where Catherine's mentioned that we mm-hmm. we go off in search of acupuncture and laser light therapy and different types of things.
As you know, many treatments in oncology are very devastating and
yes.
can challenge the will and the essence of a person's life and can be a fine. There's a point in the book where someone says, well, their job was to push him over to the edge. Let's hope he didn't push them too far. I mean, Greg was at that kind of edging spot mm-hmm. in the
quality of life.
Quality of life.
Was it still there?
Right, just getting to eat and walk was a challenge for him.
So this story has a wonderful, very happy ending. The beginning was dramatic and very difficult. The ending is just the opposite. We finally get good scans.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think I might have written the cancer left as it came into my life without apology or explanation. So, yeah. So it we got the scans and it was difficult to believe that the cancer was gone. And I think that dogs cancer patients after their treatment maybe. Their cancer is, quote, in remission. Oncologists never say, Aaron, that you're cured. They mm-hmm. refuse to use that word,
yeah.
cure, the four-letter word. And they say it's in remission. And so you never can say, oh, that'll never happen to me again, or that was yesterday, and yesterday's gone. It's something that's always with you in your mind. Mm-hmm. The cancer really infects your mind. You know, so it gets into your mind, and that's where they can't get to it, no matter what you use. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
So the book is available everywhere.
It's available on Amazon as both Kindle and hard copy, and it's also in local bookstores.
Local bookstores.
Yeah. yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And your blog, listeners want to...
Sure, we have a blog, and it's tcparadox.com.
Would you spell that out? Are you punning on the word? Or?
Well, TCPARADOX.com.
Okay. Yep. I didn't know if you were going to use a C on the docs or not. The book again is A Good Fight, A Story of Cancer, Love, and Triumph. Catherine Roth, Greg Holmes, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron.